Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. ArchiCAD is the official BIM software of the Entree Architect community. ArchiCAD BIM software enables design, collaboration, visualization, and project delivery no matter the project size or complexity. With flexible licensing options and a dedicated support team to guide us along the way, ArchiCAD is an ideal choice for firms and projects of any size. I encourage you to reach out and talk to the folks at Graphisoft by visiting our own dedicated webpage at graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. There's even an exclusive special offer waiting for our Entree Architect community. Go now to graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. That's graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Tom Nguyen, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Why, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. Tom is a residential architect. He's his residential architecture journey began in 1994 with an internship at RWA Architects in Cincinnati. And that would take him to Chicago to work under Thomas Beebe, learning classical and traditional principles and details. And then subsequently, Stuart Cohen and Julie Hacker, where traditional details were fused with a tailored traditional design approach. Following his time with Cohen and Hacker, Tom formed his own practice, at which time he coincidentally met Wade Weissman, who he's now working with. I spoke with Wade back in May of 2020, episode 323. We talked about how earned trust leads to your best work. It was a great conversation, so I recommend after this episode, you go listen to episode 323. He bumped into Wade Weissman at that point, and several years later, they came together again. And today, Tom works with Wade as the studio director.
Yes, that's correct. I actually bumped into Wade, I think it was at a residential architect convention in San Diego, and it must have been, well, I think the first time we met was 15 or 16 years ago. And so we had an intermittent, though long-running conversation for several years. We'd meet up every year in a new city. This was a conference, I think it was called the Reinvention, that was put on by Hanley Wood years ago.
I remember Reinvention.
I think they've discontinued that since the pandemic, which is a shame, but it was a really great opportunity for a bunch of residential architects to come together in another city and be able to share each other's work. And I enjoyed that one an awful lot.
I would love to learn and even go back further than that. I'd love to learn more about you specifically, Tom. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and maybe who or what inspired you to become an architect?
Sure. Okay. Well, you know, I guess everybody probably has a story that they can think about or look back on that goes, you know, pretty deep into childhood. And I think that maybe the first inkling or surfacing of an interest in architecture, the creation of spaces, actually goes back to my time living on a small family farm in Xenia, Ohio, or just outside of Xenia, Ohio. And in particular, we had this really cool old barn that was in a barnyard with a silo and a Quonset hut and a corn crib. But, you know, we had about 100 cows that we raised on that farm. And so consequently, we also filled the barn with huge piles of hay and hay bales. And I don't know if you've ever played around with hay bales, but they're like big bristly Legos.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, when the middle of winter came about and we started, you know, the cows started to eat down the hay bales, there was a lot more room in the barn to start playing with those large scale Lego blocks. And so I made forts and tunnels and trapdoors and you know, it's a wonder that I actually made it out of childhood. I think I created a small pit that my grandfather landed in unexpectedly one afternoon, and boy, did I catch heck for it. But you know, I really did enjoy sort of working at almost life size, you know, in the barn, creating those forts. But it wasn't really until several years later, 5-6 years later, when my mother remarried, she married my stepfather, and they decided to build a house. And I think that was the summer between my 8th and 9th grade, so between middle school and my first year in high school. And, you know, it was not a custom house. It was definitely one of the more developer-driven things. But, you know, what was really remarkable about it is that it was panelized and it was built in about a 3-month period of time. So every single day that summer, something new and interesting and exciting was going on. And, you know, I got to watch the house, well, go from what was, a half acre empty field on the edge of the woods to a hole in the ground, to seeing the footprint of the house traced out in concrete, and then just ultimately get pulled up out of the ground, and it became a real, you know, functional, operational thing. And it was just fantastic. You know, to this day, the smell of wet cement just kind of gets me going.
Brings you right back.
It sure does. So that, you know, I was about 13, I think, when we built the house, and that really was the sort of quintessential moment in my formative history, and that moment in time when I, you know, quit being a kind of listless and aimless, angsty teenager to somebody who actually had an orientation and an interest in the future that they could work towards. And so that was really huge for me.
Did you know at that point that about architects and architecture, or were you just interested in construction and the process at that point?
Yeah, I did know about architects and architecture. I was also a member. There was a group that was it was an offshoot of the Boy Scouts, I think. It was they had these explorer posts.
Yeah.
And I think it was shortly after I developed that interest in architecture with the construction of my family's home that I found that an explorer group that actually was fed by a bunch of different high schools in the small Ohio town where we lived. And I actually got to meet several recent graduates from a couple of the local architecture schools. I was in Ohio, so there was a guy who was running this explorer post from he actually graduated from OSU and was working at one of the larger firms downtown, and he really took an interest in us kids. And taking us on field trips and through various architecture firms and just kind of exploring, exposing us to that whole world of architecture. And at one point in time, I think this was right around my senior year in high school, there was a competition that was held for the design of a new fire station that was going to be in one of the adjacent suburbs. And I entered that competition and remarkably won it. Now, they never ended up building the project, but that was a tremendous amount of fun for me to essentially have an experience that was similar to, you know, a studio experience in architecture school before I'd even gotten there. So, I had an opportunity to practice my hand a little bit about casting a vision on a site and generating a design that was, you know, functional and practical and beautiful and all of those things that good architecture should be.
Yeah, that's such a great story that highlights the importance of us as architects reaching out to the younger generation, right? Even before they recognize that they might want to become an architect, right? That just expose them to the profession so they recognize and understand what architects really do. That's a great story.
Yeah, and there's sure a long list of things that we do on a day-to-day basis in our profession. I mean, you know as well as any how many hats we have to wear over the course of a given project. It's really pretty remarkable. I sometimes joke with our residential clients that I've also got a minor in counseling, marital counseling.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with residential projects, for sure.
Yeah.
So I shared a little bit about your professional journey. Talk a little bit about how and when you met Wade the second time and, you know, decided to join the firm. And what's that story?
Yeah, so I was actually living and working in Chicago at the time for an architecture firm that did both architecture and interior design. And I actually have an interest in that, you know, finer level of detail that comes with not just the interior architecture, but, you know, the materials and the finishes. And so that was a really positive experience for me, but, you know, it kind of gotten to a point living in Chicago where I would say, honestly, you know, it's an amazing city with an incredible, intense, and rich architectural fabric and history. But after living there for 17 years, I was really yearning for a simpler life experience. In Chicago, you can get anywhere you want, but it's going to take some time. And, 45 minutes to an hour, hour and a half, you never really know based on whether there's a Cubs game or a Bears game. And it's, you know, kind of a stressful experience. And, you know, ultimately I was looking to try and de-escalate the stress that I had, but still continue doing the same qualitative work that I was doing at, you know, a national level. And I had a friend who had left and come to Wade's office a little bit prior. And so, you know, he kept reaching out to me, texting me, you know, like, are you sure you don't want to move up here? And I was like, no, wrong way. I wanted to head west. But ultimately, you know, the conversation did end up moving in a direction that had me at least go up for an interview and to see the office. And it's a really remarkable office. I think you can see images of it on our website. It's a beautiful environment to work in. And, honestly, it's the best group of people I think I've ever had an opportunity to work with either. A lot of people talk about how the other individuals in their office or the office is large as like a family. And I think I feel that more acutely here than I ever have before. And Milwaukee's, it's a 90-minute drive down to Chicago. So my friends are still down there, and it's easy to get down to see them. But, the quality of life is really quite phenomenal here. And so for me, it's really optimized, a lot of personal needs with my professional pursuits in really good way.
What's your role today with Wade?
So I am the studio director here, and I am on the management team with Wade and our controller, our business strategist, and one other senior architect. And, you know, my personal day-to-day is largely working with our project managers on an individual basis on all of the projects that they are working on. We have a staff of a little over 30 right now, including administrative staff. And we have, I'd have to do a head count to give you the specific numbers, but roughly 8 or 10 project managers. And those 8 to 10 project managers are managing roughly 20 to 25 active projects at any given time. I think we put out just under 70 invoices in a month. So some of those projects are lesser active, either in early stages of design or in, you know, construction administration, where the level of the team's commitment or effort is, you know, is moderated. So I ultimately work with the individual project managers. We pair the project manager with each project at the outset of the project, even if Wade or another individual in the office is maybe taking the first pass at casting the initial design vision. They're still involved with the project, helping to coordinate meetings and facilitate communication with the clients. But ultimately, their involvement, if they in any particular instance, even if they aren't given the white sheet opportunity, and some of our project managers have been asking for that, and we're trying to facilitate white sheet opportunities for the individual project managers, but they will be with the project from its inception all the way through its completion. And generally speaking, I am also there essentially from the first phone call. So I do a lot of business development and writing the proposals and contracts to bring the work in. But then, because I've been a part of the conversation from the outset, I'm able to provide a great deal of continuity in terms of the project management. You know, sometimes somebody, you know, one of your project managers decides to start a family, or they get sick, or they need to have an operation, and you know, obviously we have a business to run, and we have you know, specific goals in terms of completing our work and getting projects submitted for permit or for out for construction, and so we need to make sure that happens. So I provide sort of a parallel and almost redundant level of oversight and continuity to support the project managers. You know, it's unfortunate. Sometimes a project manager decides to take another position and move on, but I'm still there to be able to transition a new team member into that place.
A firm with 30 people at EntreArchitect, we call you the not so small firms.
Yes. Yeah. We're a large, small firm.
Yeah. You're still a small firm, but you're you're not so small firm.
Yes, we have a lot of the structural complexities of a large firm without, you know, having 300 people on payroll.
Right. Yeah. And you talked earlier about the you didn't use this word about the culture mm-hmm. of the firm, but you talked about mm-hmm. it in terms of a family and a great place to work. That it's mm-hmm. that's a big piece of what drew you there. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming what draws other people there. A firm of 30 people, relatively large company mm-hmm. with all types
large
of
for residential practice.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And I'm just saying the number of people that a culture like that has to be very intentional and planned and thought about, right?
Something, that's true.
Something like that doesn't just happen when you have 30 people. Somebody had to have either innately cultivated the culture or specifically planned on the culture.
Well, we do spend a lot of time planning, and we have one woman who is essentially a staffing coordinator. She's also a really phenomenal young architect, is in her own right, but she helps with coordinating the contracts and projects start times and how we maneuver our staff from one project to the next, because, you know, obviously at any given stage in a project's development, the need for staff is, you know, will go up as you move into documents and then start to taper off again. And so, you know, we do have a team of junior architects that we that are essentially floating free radicals that move in between project managers and project teams. You know, we do spend, you know, a significant amount of time, several hours a week, just trying to figure out how to maneuver projects and teams throughout the office. So yes, it does require a great deal of intentional planning.
With, I'm assuming there's also lots of experience levels, people coming in at a lower level, people at a higher level. Is there an intentional mentoring process that your firm goes through?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's still an evolving thing, but yes. So, you know, outside of a few exceptions, when it comes to hiring, we've had, for one reason or another, a little bit of a challenge getting more experienced staff to join us here in Milwaukee. That's not that they don't exist, but a culture of high-end residential architecture outside of the four walls of this office doesn't really exist here. And so we have a hard time finding experienced architects with an interest and background in residential architecture here. They exist in other adjacent cities, but trying to get them to relocate has been a little bit of a challenge. So one of the things that we have found is that it's generally been easier for us to recruit recent graduates. And we do have a pretty strong relationship with the University of Notre Dame. And they just so happen to have a program or a curriculum that's dedicated to classical and traditional architecture. And so it's helpful to have familiarity with, you know, the kit of parts and the compositional right. principles that are taught in a classically oriented school like that. When you're working on houses that do tend to fall into that, you know, traditional and classical paradigm. And so we usually pick up a couple, you know, at least one, if not two recent graduates almost every year. And we have a buddy system. So we'll pair them with somebody who is also a similarly recent graduate, but had been with the office for 2 or 3 years, so that they have somebody to show them the ropes and help them with the various processes that we have in place. And, you know, when we have had more experienced graduates, we'll pair them with, you know, one of the senior project managers to similarly provide them with, you know, somebody to support their onboarding into the office. Seems like you'd asked a little bit about mentoring. So that's a, you know, certainly a big interest in of mine. I'm less interested in, you know, I'm not so interested in running a fulfillment department where, you know, the individual responsibilities for a given person in our office is, you know, so broken down that, you know, there's, you know, Dave, that guy just does CA and that person over there just does, you know, interior elevations and that person just does the technical drawings and that guy over there is really good at design. So he's just going to be, you know, coming up with the pretty pictures. I very firmly believe that for us, it's almost a matter of survival to create a staff of project managers and architects who are well-rounded enough to be able to both generate a design concept, but also have the technical skills and experience to be able to make that pretty picture a reality. And then, of course, the foresight that it takes to be able to bring a project through construction to completion and see all of the hidden in plain sight conditions that can, for lack of a better term, sort of wreak havoc on a beautiful and otherwise, you know, visually simple interior.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by RCAT.com. Can't find the product data that you're looking for? You might be using the wrong search engine. Broad searches result in consumer products, out-of-date information, and websites that hide or don't have the information that you're looking for. If you need specifications, CAD, or BIM, RCAT.com is your search engine. Find and download the up-to-date data that you need fast. RCAT.com is free and requires no registration. So try RCAT today. That's ARCAT.com. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So how does that process work? I mean, strategically, right, or tactically, in order to develop those staff members to sort of have that well-rounded experience. Is there a specific process that they go through, or is it just the culture
It's not something that's specifically codified in terms of a process that we go through. I do spend a lot of time personally investing in the project managers. We spend time, I will do an interim review of a drawing set, and I can just glance at a sheet and I can tell you, the 6 or 8 problems that I see with it immediately. And there are things like, how materials turn the corner, what happens when you transition between floors and what that means in terms of wall thicknesses, whether or not there's, room for something as simple as a light switch, whether or not you can get that item into the space after the house is framed. So I talk a lot about, the practical necessities of architecture. And we do a lot of sketching and sketching through details. And I mean, we get into, thermal bridging concepts and, high level building science. And it's in this ongoing conversation that I have with all of the project managers. And it's putting together a set of documents in a thoughtful way. It's, a set of drawings is like a set of assembly instructions for, a model that you might buy from the store.
Right.
And so it's all about how information is conveyed, and it's about conveying information in a way that is legible and understandable for the general contractor and for the subcontractors. And, I spend a lot of time working with them, getting them to visualize, I'm a carpenter or I'm an electrician, and you're asking for me to set this light switch in this particular location. Well, there's not a door casing installed on the door yet because it's just rough framing, and I'm not standing on the finish floor. That could be a couple inches higher. I'm actually standing on the subfloor. Well, so what are the things that are going to be in existence at the time that a particular element is fixed to the structure? And so, there's a lot of conversations that we have about buildability and construction sequencing in order to be able to assemble a set of drawings that is both beautiful, but also practically addresses the needs of the contractors in the field. And, this is, I think, in a certain sense, an extension of an orientation that we have here at WWA of being very collaborative with our general contractor base. When something goes wrong on a job site, and invariably it does, and sometimes it's our fault and sometimes it's the contractor's fault, but we have an orientation towards rolling with the punches and having the design process be something that is additive in nature, because there's nothing more heartbreaking for a client who had just been at the job site the day prior to see that a wall had been taken down because of, you know, some mistake that had been made. And so at any point in time that we can find a solution that keeps the contractor whole and the project generally on schedule, we're going to, you know, work towards that solution in a very, you know, constructive and collaborative way. And, you know, I think that, like I said, I think that's just an extension of the way that we think about conveying information to the very skilled tradespeople that we work with.
Yeah, I when I spoke with Wade, we talked about that pretty extensively, the relationship that your firm has with contractors. Again, if you're listening and you want to listen to that, it's episode 323. Great conversation. When you're talking about the project managers and the work that you do, actually, listeners, you should go to wadeweissmanarchitecture.com and go look at the work that we're talking about here. Very, very finely detailed and beautiful residential, traditional residential architecture, you know, top of the line, best, you know, type of architecture, beautiful homes. And so you're talking about the detail of that kind of stuff, Tom, and how that detail happens, right? And detailing the drawing so the light switch ends up where you want it in the wall at the time. It's not a random location. It happens right where you want it.
Yeah, you don't have to cut the casing around the light switch.
Right, you know. Exactly. And so in order to get that, you have to teach that, right? And a lot of that, from experience, also being a residential architect, a lot of that comes from experience, right? Making those mistakes and then recognizing that you've made that mistake and you're never going to do it again. And an accumulation of those becomes, you know, you start to know what you're doing. But in order to avoid that, right, you don't want that to happen on your projects. So you have to teach
that. You let the guy who made a lot of mistakes run the office.
As he raises his hand.
Yeah.
Is there, in addition to sort of the coaching and sort of the reviews and having them be taught, like actually, you know, teaching them, is there sort of a shadow process that they go through that they sort of can see the things you're doing, so they learn need to learn?
There are, you know, when we have somebody in our office who is, you know, roughly in that 5 to 7 year experience range, so they've been on a project, and we, you know, even with our junior staff, if we can keep them on a project, and not just, you know, be the person who just draws the interior elevations, but if we can keep them on the project and have them attend site visits with their project managers and get them exposed to the job site, that really facilitates the learning curve significantly. But when we get the staff who have been with us for long enough, they've been on a few job sites, they've worked with a couple different project managers and gotten some of the different flavors that individual PMs bring to their own processes. And we feel like, you know, they are keyed in on the right information, the right notion about how a project should progress, when they're providing insights about issues that they see in the drawing set and also providing, you know, some potential solutions. They're like, okay, well, that's somebody who is, you know, ready to start, you know, down the path towards becoming a fully fledged project manager. And so we'll try and pick a smaller project. Now, sometimes, you know, the addition renovation projects can be highly complex. So if it's a smaller project, like a guest house or a cabin or just a smaller residential structure somewhere in the woods, that's relatively straightforward and simple, we will actually pair them with one of our senior project managers, and they will meet with their senior project manager once a week or as needed, right?
Yeah.
And that senior PM will essentially show them the ropes of, well, this is how you, so I don't know if you're familiar with, there's a Dell Tech product that we use called Ajira that, you know, does our invoicing and billing and timesheets and that sort of thing. But we also use it for scheduling our projects and for looking at how far out our workflow, you know, is projecting into the future. And so, you know, there's a bit of learning curve, you know, with that software. And so the project managers will essentially work with our junior project managers and show them the ropes, you know, in terms of our internal systems and how those things actually operate. But the project that the senior project manager isn't actually doing the project or running their project, they're just providing the kind of support and oversight that they need. Because, you know, myself in the current role that I have, my calendar gets booked out pretty solidly for a couple of weeks, and it's harder for me to do a drive-by, you know, appointment with somebody who might need that extra level of support. So we like to make sure that there's somebody who is, you know, proximally located near them in the office, who is familiar with the project but isn't specifically responsible for its development. So, you know, again, it's a buddy system of sorts.
Yeah. Who is managing the client experience at your firm? Is that project managers?
So when you say managing the client experience, are you talking about who is the person who handles the day-to-day, you know, information exchange?
The whole process. So, you know, from the point where, you know, once they've signed on to be a client and the design mm-hmm. process starts, who's meeting with the client to do that design process, and then who's managing the rest of the project with the client, and how does that handoff happen if it's a different person?
There's a lot of different answers to that, because, you know, we have, you know, larger, more complicated projects. We have smaller, simpler projects, and depending on the level of sophistication or firepower that, you know, a project needs, the initial concept drawing can be generated by Wade or myself or our director of design, Eric Slavin. If a project manager has a specific interest in, you know, scratching that itch and generating a schematic design, we'll give them the program and they'll, you know, start to sketch through, you know, a few ideas, and they'll meet with myself and Wade or myself and Eric. And we'll provide, you know, that kind of desk crit opportunity. So there are a lot of different ways that a project's design vision is realized. So I don't have, a one size fits all answer for you there.
The attorneys often say it depends. That's usually
it depends, and that is true. Yes,
that's usually the answer from the attorneys. So that's very interesting, because that's always a difficult process with the client, right? Because you want to make sure that the client is managed and handled well.
And so I'll be, you know, I try and be in every client meeting, which doesn't always happen. If I'm not there, you know, usually Wade will be able to be there. Sometimes it's both of us. It's another one of those things that it just kind of depends on, you know, whether the client's particularly high touch or not. And at what stage in the project's development we happen to find ourselves in.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you share sort of the behind the scenes of Wade Weissman Architects and understand how these beautiful houses are designed.
It's a finely polished, well-oiled machine. Don't let anybody ever tell you differently.
It's we're talking to thousands of architects who are primarily small firm architects and are striving to figure it all out. Right. And so it's great to hear how your firm does the things that they do.
I think it's always good. And I was, you know, a sole proprietor for 8 years or so in Chicago. And I remember the first time that I was working on a design for my first house, and I realized there was nobody else to talk to or to ask. And I just had to make a decision. And it almost didn't matter what the decision was. Just that a decision be made, right, and that you then kind of play out what the implications are, you know, as time goes on. But I think it's a very frightening prospect for a lot of people when they have a blank sheet of paper in front of them and you want to put a line down, but you want to make sure it's in the right spot and the right length. And, you know, you can get a little bit paralyzed. So it's not so much what the idea is, but that you do it.
Yeah, that's good advice. How about what? And let me ask you that final question that I ask everybody, because that was a very good lead into something like that? What is the one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Self-care, I think. I think that we've all had health challenges in the past or witnessed people who have. And I think that if you're going to be running a practice and if you have that kind of entrepreneurial personality, there's always a lot of drive that comes with that. And it's very easy to drive yourself into the ground. And so I think, anybody who is, and I think that that's true too for a lot of the project managers. I mean, these are demanding projects with demanding yeah. schedules and demanding clients. And, you know, the number of hours that it takes to realize a project can be extreme with people. You know, we try not to have people scheduled, you know, more than say 42 to 45 hours a week, but, you know, we consistently see people in the mid to upper 50s. And I think that, a big project requires a great deal of stamina. It is a long game. It is something which is, which occurs over, you know, a minimum of a 3, if not a 5-year period of time. And you have to learn to pace yourself. And so that's kind of why I'm saying, I think that self-care is really important to be able to make sure that, you know, after those 5 years, there's still something left of you that's useful.
Yes, that's very wise advice, especially now, you know, having come out of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are struggling not only mentally, but also physically, right? That they've, mm-hmm. when you're locked in your mm-hmm. house for 2 years, you don't move around very much.
Yes.
And I'm starting to see people talk about that the more obvious thing is the wellness and the mental health, right? That people are sort of trying to rebuild from. But the physical, wellness is critical as well. That you have to be intentional about getting up and moving and getting out and taking care of yourself. And so that being a priority is a great answer to that question. So thank you for that and for the reminder, because I think a lot of us who are listening right now are nodding our heads. Yeah, that's
yeah,
me.
Yeah, you've right? got that's to do
we,
it.
We need to make sure we do that before it's too late, because often you can get to a point where, you know, some of the things that could happen from that are irreversible, right? That mm-hmm. as you get older, right? Today is my birthday. I'm 53 years
happy
old
birthday.
Today. Thank you.
Okay.
And you know, when you start getting into your 50s, you realize, you know, the things that you did as your 20 and 30 year old, mm-hmm. you know, some of those bad habits that you had that lasted for years are now sort of rising up and becoming issues that are irreversible, right? Those are things that you know, you did because you didn't take care of yourself for 20 years. And so it's a very good reminder for that, for me as well. So thank you. His name is Tom Wynn. The firm name is Wade Weissman Architecture. You should go check out the website at wadeweissmanarchitecture.com. We will have a link to that on the show notes. Tom, thank you for coming by and sharing about Wade Weissman Architecture and about your experience and the sort of a little bit of it, the behind the scenes of how those beautiful houses get designed and built. So I appreciate you coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was a pleasure to talk to you today.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, share a link with a friend. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands of architects just like you. Please share a rating, write a review, share a link to this episode with a friend. I'd appreciate it. Links to all our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. It's the network dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at Gable Media at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Go check it out. We have, I think, 13 podcasts over there now. gablemedia.com. And before we wrap up, a special thank you to our partners at Graphisoft for helping our community of architects make the transition to BIM with ArchiCAD software. Go now to graphisoft.com/us/EntreArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioning to help make your architecture firm a success. Visit graphisoft.com/us/EntreArchitect to learn more. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage. Love, learn, and go share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.